Okay. Back up.
Okay.
What is your full name?
Okay. I'm John Clyde Conlon.
Okay. And where and when were you born?
I was born in Midland, Michigan, which is close to Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Okay.
I lived there for 4 years, and my family moved to Peoria, Illinois, which is where I grew up. That was the home of my parents, and then also where my grandparents came to when they left Ireland. And Peoria is halfway between St. Louis and Chicago. It's downstate, considered to be downstate Illinois farmland, but Peoria is probably the largest next to Chicago. Rockford's in there somewhere too, but we always had healthy competition between Rockford and Peoria for second best. But Peoria is a little more of a blue-collar town. I should mention what I mean by that is a lot of jobs with a distillery, Keystone, steel and wire, Caterpillar tractor, Pabst Blue Ribbon had a big plant there. So most of those were the big employers when I was a kid growing up.
Wow. And then you said Peoria's farmland. Were your grandparents farmers?
Yes. My grandparents were farmers. And actually, on my mom's side, her parents were both farmers.
They were all farmers.
Yeah, my mom grew up on a farm right outside of Peoria.
Great. Yeah. And farmers back in Ireland,
yes,
as well.
Yeah.
The ancestors. Mm-hmm. Okay. What jobs have you had?
Oh, well, I just recently retired from teaching. I was an elementary school teacher, and I've taught in a few places in Montana. When I graduated from college, my first teaching job was in Washington, D.C., because I went to school out there, and I taught inner city, fourth and fifth grade. Mm-hmm. Then I really wanted to get out of the city, so I was looking for somewhere to live, and had been out west before, and basically looked on a map, saw Missoula, and thought, well, this looks like a pretty good spot to be, and came out. Then eventually, because I couldn't find a job teaching around here, I taught up a couple different places, taught at East Glacier, which is on the Blackfeet Reservation, mm-hmm. and went down to Arizona, taught on the Navajo Indian Reservation.
Wow.
Came back up here again because the job opened up outside of Kalispell, and then eventually that led to a teaching job in Missoula.
Oh,
so
wow.
I kind of did the, I was hoping to get into Missoula when I first got here, but it just wasn't happening. And so anyway, I retired out of Missoula, taught over on the north side at Lowell Elementary.
About what year was that?
Well, I started, I just retired 2 years ago, so yeah, I worked seven years at Lowell.
Wow.
Yeah, so I
so
finished
you've been
up
here
in
how many years?
I came out here in 1979.
Okay.
I lived in Missoula for 3 years. I had a little bit of money and I was looking for a house, and so I bought a place right over here on 3rd Street, which is a really old house, about 100 years old right now. It's it's on historic register. I got on the register, I remodeled it. You know, we were looking for a bigger place. So 3 years ago, we bought this place, not so much for the house, but because I like to garden and landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was an ideal lot because it's an acre. And so we really only moved 3 blocks.
Yeah. So
yeah.
The garden and the landscape is important to you. So farming's still part of your heritage.
Yes,
a little
I think it is. Yeah. it always has been. And I really like, in fact, my grandparents always had a garden on the side lot. My mom always had a garden. She used to grow tomatoes. But in Illinois, obviously, you can really do that.
You
and corn.
That.
But I do have that in my background. My mom was a real outdoors person, and so I learned to ride when I was, you know, a little kid. And she was very independent. My mom, you know, was in, I guess it would be kind of like horseback riding clubs that you have here. You know, you go in the backcountry.
Mm-hmm.
She would go on these, you know, 25-mile rides or whatnot. And she was, you know, had that background. So I think I probably got that from her. But having spent a lot of time with my grandparents who came from Clare, I did a lot of work outside with them in the garden, so I guess it's been on both sides of the family. Yeah.
Okay. Are you married?
Yes, I've been.
And at
yes.
what age did you marry?
Well, I was married in 1973. I have a daughter from that marriage, Erin.
Give her name.
Erin.
Her full name.
Yeah, Erin Elizabeth Conlon. She's married now, so she's Erin Fitz, and she lives in Miami, Florida. That particular marriage didn't end very well, so I was divorced, and then I remarried in 1993, mm-hmm. and that's my wife, Lorraine, mm-hmm. and she's Lorraine Rowe Conlon, and she's a pharmacist, and she works in Missoula. Mm-hmm. And that was, when we were married, that she wanted to work Indian Health Service, so that's pretty much how I got up to East Glacier and Browning and New Mexico and Arizona, because in her job, at that time through Indian Health Service, that's how you moved up the ranks, mm-hmm. was to transfer around. Unlike teaching, it's you're probably smarter to stay at the same place. but anyway, since the pharmacist makes more money, obviously, mm-hmm. then I pretty much was okay. And those were great experiences, because I found that I really liked working with people who appreciated what you were doing. Mm-hmm. And those are underserved communities. It's a kind of the, I don't know, the forgotten America, so to speak.
And, can you explain that a little bit?
Well, the resources aren't there, for one, to support education, you know, even preschool, you know, which I really think is where a lot of emphasis should be put in education, because mm-hmm. those kids need to get a basis for what they're, you know, for education. And if we're not going to fund that, then, you know, I just look at that as kind of the lost year, so to speak. And they get into school and not ready for some of the things that are going on. And you really see that more the grade level that I taught, with fifth grade. Kids coming into fifth grade reading on a second or third grade level, it makes it really hard, because fifth grade, you're kind of moving in more into the textbook kind of thing with mm-hmm. social studies and geography and things like that. And they don't have that background in reading to make that jump, and it can be very frustrating. So I noticed quite a bit, and even at Lowell on the north side, you know, mm-hmm. it's generally areas that are underserved, you know, maybe low on the economic ladder. The kids do struggle, but they are a joy to work with. Mm-hmm. I still keep in touch with through Facebook, which is kind of funny, but I have they find you.
But I did
that mainly because I wanted to keep in touch with my daughter and then also my family. Well, anyway, I have four kids now that I taught at East Glacier in the early 90s, you know, and one's, you know, just got a PhD from Bozeman, another one's an actress, another one's going to law school, you know, and it's just amazing that, you know, you don't, as a teacher, you don't see that when you have them.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you know, you connect with these kids 20-some years later, and they're you know, on their way. You know,
yeah.
Now it's up to them. But so that's one really kind of delayed joy or satisfaction you get from the teaching.
Delayed gratification,
yeah,
from teaching.
Yeah, because it can be a grind. You know, it really can be, and it's not easy. Even though, you know, recently with the thing in Wisconsin, there's a lot of negative comments about teachers and their summers off and things like that, which is really far from the truth. But anyway, it's and I guess another thing with teaching is that I don't think the general population understands what a teacher does.
Yeah.
You know, so those are just some general observations that I have about teaching. But I do think that, getting back to working with kids that I've worked with, I think the parents appreciate that you're doing it, and that you're making a commitment to them. And mm-hmm. I don't think a lot of the, especially with Native Americans and with African Americans, I don't think they've had a real good experience with maybe the larger society. And there's a lot of barriers there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, and I don't think a lot of people really understand that in this country.
The barriers.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Is your spouse or partner also of Irish ancestry?
She has a little bit. More of her family is English, from
okay.
Cornwall. On her mother's side, her mother's, well, Lorraine's grandfather, Walsh, is from Ireland, Inistig, which is south of Kilkenny.
Okay.
And her cousin Patrick Walsh still has that farm, and she's met him twice, and I just met him this November.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and he has, that's such a beautiful area down there, south of Kilkenny. It's a huge farmland. He has about 160 acres or so.
Oh.
Yeah, and he does it all by his lonesome. His kids, the three kids, one's in America, one's in Iceland, and one's in outside of Dublin, so... It's kind of a typical story with farms. You know, the kids don't keep going.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so we need to backtrack a little bit here.
Yeah.
Could you give today's date?
March 26th, 2011.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
And it's Friday morning at, what, 9 a.m.?
Yeah.
Okay. And you said you have how many children?
I have one.
You have one child?
I have one child. Erin,
and she's the one in Florida.
She's in Miami, Florida.
Okay.
She's works at a botanical gardens. It's a Fairchild Botanical Gardens. It's kind of a big area down there. Her husband's a high school teacher, and they have a daughter, my granddaughter Eliza, and she is in the fourth grade this year.
Mm.
So it's kind of hard because. They're there, and you know, once or twice a year we get together. But anyway, Erin is very laid back, but likes nature, and so this is kind of her thing. Although she's gotten out of the actual working outside, she's in charge of the publications, which is they have a huge bookstore down there, and all kinds of stuff that they do with tours and things like that. So. She has a supervisory job, which is kind of funny for her because she's not I don't really look at her as a real take charge kind of person,
mm-hmm.
but she's been with them now for quite a few years, and it's good to see because when both of them graduated from college, I didn't know if they'd would be able to get jobs or not. You know, the worry of every parent, but,
mm-hmm.
And then in fact, he was, her husband wanted to go into the military, which I'm really glad that didn't work out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he had some kidney stones, and at that time they wouldn't take him, which I don't think that would be the case right now.
Probably not.
Yeah. But anyway, so he ended up getting a job teaching. He's from Florida, so I'm assuming they're going to stay there. Yeah.
Mm.
But they do like coming up here quite a bit.
I bet they do like to.
Yeah, and she grew up in that. She grew up in that house.
Oh, she grew up in that house. That really nice.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, and that's a really tiny place, but anyway. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so let's go to your family.
Okay.
I think that's what our focus is going to be today. When did your ancestors leave Ireland?
My grandfather left in 1898.
Okay.
And
can you give your grandfather's name?
Yes, it's Michael Francis Conlon.
Okay.
And he came over...
Do you know about how old he was? I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. He was born in 1873, so he was 25, 26 years old, right in that age group.
Okay, and then you were going to say he came over...
Oh, he came over, from what I have been able to piece together, grew up in Ennistymon, which is County Clare. It's about 2 miles, a mile and a half from Lahinch, which is right on the coast of West Clare. So, you know, he was a farmer, but also knew the water, I think, too, pretty much, which I've never been a water person, so. but anyway, he went to Limerick, and then I'm assuming took a train to Cork and then left out of Cove. And when I was over there in November, I got to go down to the Cove Cultural Center, so I got to see where he left, where my grandmother left from, and then also my great aunt Catherine, which was very, very moving just
mm-hmm.
to see that because the family was telling me that there's this huge steeple there at Cove, and that was as the ship got farther and farther away from Cove, that steeple with the cross was the last thing they saw. And so I was really trying to visualize that when I was there, I was kind of focusing on that. But anyway, went to New York, and came in through Ellis Island, and I have his ship thing there too if you want to take a look at that. I got that from Ellis Island, it's a photocopy. And then came to Peoria, Illinois. The reason he came to Peoria was because there was a farm in back of them in Anastymon, the O'Briens, and this fellow named Thomas O'Brien had come to Peoria. And so I guess he had given that information back saying that, you know, this would be an okay place to come. And I guess the O'Briens and the Conlins were very close. When I was there in November, they told me where the O'Briens live, and I go back, when I go back again, I'd like to connect with them just to find out with this relative, who their relative is. But anyway, Thomas O'Brien came over, must have sent word back saying that, you know, Peoria is fine, there's some jobs or whatnot. So then on the ship manifest here, he mentions that he's going to Peoria, Illinois to join a friend, Thomas O'Brien. So he came over. There was a period of about 4 years where I guess my grandfather was sending money back to my grandmother, who is at that time was Anna Hogan, H-O-G-N. They were on adjoining farms right across the road from one another, and he was sending money back to her so that that would pay for her passage to come over to America. So that took about 4 years. The funny thing about that is, I guess, I kind of got kidded about this when I went over there to Ireland. He was supposed to be sending that back to his family, but I guess he was sending some to the family, but he was also sending some to her. So when I went over there in November, that story's been passed down, and they were wanting to know where the rest of the money was. They were kidding me about that. And I said, I don't know. All you get is me. She came over 4 years later in 1902, and then they were married shortly after that.
And they were married in Peoria?
Yes. Okay. He must have been an incredible saver of money because from what I can tell from the census records that I've gone through, he lived in a rooming house with this family called, they were Irish. It was McKinney, but it was spelled a different way, but I noticed that it is like a McKinney. And he was a boarder there for a while on the south side of Peoria. South side of Peoria has more of a reputation for more of a rougher type part of town. It's not industrial, but the railroad is down there. It's the old downtown part. So he lived there with
them. Lived in this boarding house.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he lived there. That's where he must have gone when he first came to Peoria. It was to the boarding house. And stayed with the McKinneys. Now, I don't know if he knew them or not, and I don't know how he got there, but he lived with them as a boarder, because that's mentioned on the census records, and I do remember my dad talking about that. So he must have been saving money and sent it over to my grandmother, and then she came over and they were married. But his first job in Peoria was on the railroad. He was they call them a car repairman. So I don't know I don't think he was so much on tracks, but I think when the cars would come through, because there was, even when I was a kid, there was a rail line that went up to Chicago. It was the Illinois Central, and I don't know if that was the one he worked on or not, but he did clean cars and just kind of general maintenance jobs. So he did get a job right off the bat.
After he married, what did he do after that?
I think he worked that job for quite a while. He also worked at a distillery,
Okay. And
I'm not for certain the name of that distillery. The one I'm thinking it probably was Hiram Walker, and that was right down on the river, because that was one of the big distilleries. He also, I think, did some kind of stuff on the side as a farm. They had in Peoria had several. You know, Missoula and here in Bitterroot, they have little truck farms and things like that. And I know that he had some experience with maybe that on the side in the summers. So he was pretty busy. When I was a kid growing up, 50s and until he passed away in the 60s, I remember him more as a retired but working as a maintenance person for one of the high schools.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the three jobs I know, actually the four jobs I know the most about would be railroad when I first came here, distillery, did some farm labor, truck farming or something, and then in later life at a high school that was right around the corner from where their house was.
Well, now,
yeah.
What about your parents?
My parents, well, my dad is a Michael. He's a Michael James Conlon.
Okay.
He was the only boy in that family.
Really?
There are four girls. The girls all married. Three of them lived in Chicago, which is where, thankfully, they did, because I got to spend a lot of time in Chicago, which is the best city. And got me out of Peoria.
Got you out of Peoria. Okay.
But my dad stayed in Peoria.
Okay.
To my knowledge, he was the first one out of that family to go to college.
Really?
Yeah.
Your father was?
Yeah. He went to St. Bede's, which was a small Catholic college in La Salle, Peru, Illinois.
Hmm.
What
did he study?
He was in business. Hmm. He, when he got out of college, before World War II, he worked for Caterpillar. But he is more in a technical kind of engineering draftsperson kind of job. And then after World War II, when he went to Michigan, he started working in banks.
Mm-hmm.
And then he eventually, when they transitioned down to Peoria, he worked at the Southside Bank, Southside Trust and Savings Bank, which is basically the neighborhood bank where he grew up and where my grandparents had their house.
Wow.
So it kind of did this really crazy circle. And then we lived on the north side of Peoria, which is right off of downtown, but on the other side. So we were not that far away from our grandparents. In fact, we used to...
Very close,
you know,
family ties then.
Yes. The Chicago branch, my three aunts were definitely city women. You know, they love the city.
And who are your three aunts?
There's Aunt Jo, Aunt Josephine,
okay.
Aunt Lil, Aunt Marie, and then my, well, I shouldn't say my favorite, but I have several favorites,
okay.
but Aunt Kate, who was the youngest of them all, she married a fellow from Iowa who was a pilot, and so he wanted to get out of the Midwest. So anyway, they lived in Oklahoma and Austin, Texas. So Aunt Kate was a little more distant in terms of that, but with the other three, my Aunt Jo married this fellow, Wayne Brown, who was in that same neighborhood in Peoria, right around the corner from where my family grew up. He was a milkman in Chicago, and he would the old milk delivery deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a fondness for baseball, Chicago Cubs.
Okay.
And Uncle Wayne, I would go up there and spend time with them, and he would work his thing at, I don't know, 4:30 or 5 o'clock. And my Aunt Jo would drop me off at Wrigley Field, and he would come and meet me after work, and we'd get there, you know, third inning or whatever. But we watched a lot of day games watching Wrigley Field, so I got to watch a lot of the great ball players with my Uncle Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
And so baseball is something that, you know, it's kind of run down through my family. My dad was a big baseball person, but my Uncle Wayne was one of those guys who, you know, really took me in and would go to all my little league baseball games. We'd come down from Chicago and,
mm-hmm.
and watch. But the Chicago branch, probably Uncle Joe Aunt Jo and Uncle Wayne were like two Chicago close ones. But Aunt Kate was just a character. She had red hair. And just used to, I don't know, just I guess spoil me, but she'd just take me everywhere whenever she would come up to Peoria.
Did she have specific mannerisms?
She was very animated.
Was she?
Very, you know, always moving. Always moving. Unfortunately, with that group, they were all smokers.
Were they?
You know, and I think, you know, I guess that was the culture, but I don't remember my grandparents, but my dad all the way. Even the sisters, and it's going to end badly.
Yeah.
And it really did, because, you know, just they're I think it just really cut their lives short.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but
most of them gone now.
Yes, in fact, they're all gone. Yeah. So I have a cousin, Joanne, who's in Chicago. She's in her 70s, and that was my Aunt Lil's daughter. And we haven't really communicated too much, although I am going to get together with her this summer, I hope. But that's really it. It's unfortunate. Which was really exciting about going to Ireland in November was because I discovered the Conlans are probably more in number than here now. My brother's has 5 kids in Minnesota, so that's the younger one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to get them to be a little bit more interested in their cultural roots.
Their culture.
Yeah, yeah, and but
why are you finding an interest in your cultural roots?
I don't know. I've always been curious. I'm a really a why kind of person, or how, and I just always felt that it was just kind of unique. Not not just for Irish. It could be Italian, German, or whatnot. But where I grew up in Peoria, it's pretty ethnically diverse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have a large African-American population, but you do have a heavy European, and I went to school with all, you know, I mean, it's predominantly Irish,
mm-hmm.
believe me. And I went to a Catholic school, which probably had a lot to do with it. But I've always just been interested in, you know, the history of this country. And I think once you read the history of this country, it's like, it leads you to something else. And then I have to say, probably this has been going on for, I don't know, probably, you know, maybe when I got into my 30s, you know, 20 some years, where I've just been trying to figure out, you know, well, what was it with my grandparents, and how did they get there? You know, all of a sudden it just kind of clicks on you that,
mm-hmm.
you know, you want to find out more about it. And then also what was going on in Ireland at the time. You know, so I've been reading a lot of time, a period history in Ireland, you know, just trying to see, well, would that have made their decision to come over here? Or
and what have you learned?
Well, I've learned that my great-grandfather basically was a, I won't say a child, but an adult of the famine, definitely, and with a lot of kids.
Yeah.
And I talked to my cousin about this in November, because my grandfather and her grandfather, as I mentioned, were twins.
Mm-hmm.
And why was it that my grandfather got to come and to America, and why was her grandfather there on the farm? And so we had some really kind of spiritual, kind of memorable conversations about that. And I have to say that at that time, I just think that it had to have been my grandfather was just so sick of being poor. You know, I just don't think they had anything. And I know from the way that they saved and just how frugal they were that, you know, they always say that about Depression era people.
Mm-hmm.
But that was something that you just noticed right off the bat. I mean, there was not a lot of extra fluff with them, but they weren't, when they got to America, but when they were in America, they weren't starving. You know, they had, but there was not a lot of extra stuff. And I think I probably, you know, that's kind of the way I am too,
mm-hmm.
you know. So I think some of that's been, but I just really tried to figure out, you know, I was so proud of them and just loved them so much,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I just wanted to, you know, and I go through these periods of time too when I first started reading about, oh, geez, they were probably discriminated against. I don't know that. I never heard them say anything about, you know, the no Irish need apply type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they had to have had some resistance to them being there. Maybe that's why Illinois was better than New York, because, you know, New York can be unfriendly, I guess. But
mm-hmm.
But I just started probably when I was in my early 30s, just reading about the famine, how that would affect families, and then just that huge wave of, you know, my grandfather really was kind of on the, not the famine era immigration, but, you know, 1898, I think he was old enough to see that it probably just, you know, wasn't something that he was thinking there might be much of a future. And then also, I've read a lot about the political and the social climate, and I don't know how he felt about that. Maybe he wasn't interested in being in the English army, or I don't know. I don't think the military was ever an option.
You were too young at the time.
Yeah.
To really ask.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So there's a lot of lost information.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
So, did your grandparents ever return to Ireland after they were in America?
No.
What about your parents?
My parents have probably been over there 8 or 9 times.
Okay.
Yeah. Now my great aunt Catherine, who I guess we'll talk about later, she did go back to Ireland.
She did.
Yeah, she decided that she wanted to spend her last years there, so
mm-hmm.
she went back in the early 70s, 1970, and passed away in 78, and
mm-hmm.
she's buried with her sister in the cemetery at Ennistymon, and on the tombstone, it says that the stone was paid for by Aunt Catherine. And but anyway, we'll discuss her, I guess, later. But she was another.
Well, if you want to talk about her now, we
oh,
can.
Well,
yeah, it's go. Let's just go with the flow.
Okay.
Yeah, tell us about your great aunt Catherine.
Well,
and how she's connected
okay.
to the family.
My grandmother Anna was in the Hogans, and there were 3 girls: Anna, my grandmother, Johanna, her sister, who stayed there on that family farm.
Okay.
And that farm's still in the Hogan group. And that's right across the road from the Conlins. And then Aunt Catherine, great Aunt Catherine Hogan. She came over 1922. And she went to Chicago.
Okay.
And the reason I think she may have gone to Chicago, she might have come down to Peoria, but she went to Chicago. I have quite a bit of information about her. She worked as a maid in a house in Chicago, and the woman that she worked for was involved with this club. I have a book here I can show you.
Okay.
It's called the Fort Knightley Club. It's this
okay.
yellow thing right here, and the Fort Knightley Club was started as basically a women's club. But they would discuss the social issues of the time, philosophy. They might have people who had been overseas and would do travel shows. And there's some pretty pretty interesting people who passed through the Fort Knightley Club. But anyway, one of the women who was pretty influential in this club hired my great aunt Catherine to be a greeter at the Fort Knightley Club. So you'd come up and she'd open the door and say, "Hi, you know, come on in." And there's some really nice pictures in the center there of that book. It's on Belmont Avenue. It's right downtown Chicago. But anyway, it was started as this philosophical discussion place for women to kind of go over the events of the day. And my great aunt Catherine also was a server. So when they'd have their big luncheons and their weddings or whatnot, she was a server
mm-hmm.
For them. It's a beautiful building. When I was a kid, we would go up to Chicago and we would go visit her, and I remember that building quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
A few years back when I was in Chicago, I went and knocked on the door again and asked if I could come in, and they were, but they did let me in. They did let me in. So I got to kind of go through that again. But she worked there for quite a few years. She started in the 20s and worked all the way up, I believe, to about 1963.
Yeah.
And she's quoted extensively in that book. It's really interesting because they'll make mention in there of, oh, Catherine Hogan commented on such and such or whatnot.
Hmm.
And I did find a piece in there about 1943. They celebrated her 20th year working there. And so they kicked in some money as kind of a little treat or a bonus, and they gave her $10. And then another part of the Fort Knightley Club gave her 20. And then the next year later, she was, it's quoted in there, as she was making $35.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a month or a week? I'll have to check. And they gave her a month's vacation. I think it was
mm-hmm.
$35 a week, and she was making, and that was right kind of in the war years. So she worked that job all the way up until the 60s.
Wow.
And at that time, she came down to Peoria and spent time with family. In fact, she spent time with us at our house. And my dad probably wasn't that thrilled about it because, you know, here's an older woman who was having trouble with her eyesight. She had developed cataracts, and I don't, you know, I've had a cataract, and I know right now it's, you know, 15 minutes they take care of it, but back then
back
I don't
then,
know what the technology was. So she was having some health problems, and then that eventually led her to a nursing home in Peoria. You know, now we're getting into my junior and senior year of high school, right, almost in 1970. And then she went down to Oklahoma with my great-aunt Catherine, or not with my aunt Catherine, so there's Kate and great-aunt Catherine living together, and that wasn't working out very well. And I think somewhere along the line she just said, you know what, I have the money. I've saved my money. I remember her saying that she just was going back to Ireland. So she went back to Ireland and went back and lived with her sister, Johanna. When I was there in November, there were pictures of her out in the hayfield on her, you know, just hanging out, kind of going through the motions like she probably did when she was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But Johanna, her sister, had two daughters. And one of the daughters, Susan, is still living, and I met her for the first time in November. She's in her 70s. So
wow.
She was telling me a few stories about Catherine when she came back. But she wanted to die in Ireland.
Did she?
Yeah, so she went back. And
why do you think that was?
I just think the tie, this job that she had at Fort Knightley, there were a lot of kind of movers and shakers.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that, you know, I have my own kind of class bias, and mm-hmm. it could have been kind of snobby, kind of hoity-toity.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really think that she fit in with that. Now, in defense of Fort Knightley Club, though, you know, Jane Addams, who was with the Hull House in Chicago, this was before Great Aunt Catherine's time, but Jane Addams did go to the Hull House when it first started.
Mm-hmm.
There's also mention in there, although my Great Aunt Catherine never said this, but the next paragraph, it's mentioned that she was serving breakfast and Eleanor Roosevelt was there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if I knew more about the Chicago social scene with some of the women, another social worker who worked with Jane Addams, I'm not really sure of this connection, her last name was Lathrop. I know she was another person who had gone through and had given talks. I think there was some dignitaries from Sweden or whatnot would come in and give these talks, and kind of the important people from Chicago, you know, would go and listen to the talk. And it was definitely for, you know, like the educated, a lot of the women who started this club were wives of professors. And, you know, that time period, I mean, you know, you can be critical of it or whatever, but when you look at the context, it was a way of promoting education.
Right.
And so, and I don't know where she really fit in with that. If she, I think she was accepted, but on another level, I don't know. I don't know if it was just the, you know, the kind of cute Irish worker that we have, or I don't know what the relationship
what
would
the
be
relationship.
But they did keep her there for a long time, and she's mentioned in that book in respectful terms. So
so you're thinking then she just wanted to go back to her roots?
Yes, I do. And she was close with Johanna.
Mm-hmm.
Her sister Johanna didn't have an easy life over there. I guess the fellow she was married to was probably not the best, and I think that Catherine probably was hoping maybe she could have been in Ireland to help her out a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
She was a spitting image of my grandmother. Both those sisters look so much alike, and Johanna to a certain extent. That woman, Catherine, she would just hug you, and just the minute she'd see you, you know, just slobber kisses all over you, you know, and when you're in high school, it's kind of embarrassing, you know, but she was just a very outgoing person. And I think if you were to be a maid or a server in a place like that, I don't know which skill came first. Maybe she brought that skill to that job, or maybe that job, you know, promoted that type of, but she was, but I think she was just tired of being in the city, and maybe the living conditions too. You know, she was still a boarder, so to speak, in a house, and maybe just felt that the last few years going back to Ireland. But I tell you, my dad took her back on the plane.
Oh, he did?
Yes, okay. He flew back.
Tell me about that.
Well, my dad, Michael James, he was a very strong, silent type kind of guy, I think, of that generation.
Okay.
Very kind of business-oriented, here's the facts kind of person, but very generous, you know, would go out of his way for anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when Great Aunt Catherine said, "Would you take me back?" You know, there was no hesitation on his part. I actually think that he was, my dad was probably closer to the Hogans and his mother than I think with the Conlins. I noticed that even when I went over there in November.
Mm.
Yeah. So he flew back with her, would have been 72 or 73. And I mentioned, I think my parents had probably been over to Ireland, had been there probably 7 or 8 times. As my dad got retired, they did more traveling, but they loved Ireland. My mom loved the horses because she was a farm girl.
Mm-hmm.
They did some golfing. They liked to golf, and Lahinch was, you know, that's the big golf course there. But they would, that probably wasn't the main focus of the trip. He would tell me quite a bit, you know, being with Johanna. He also had a cousin, Kitty Armstead, who, I have a picture of her too, who he was connected with.
Mm-hmm.
That was his first cousin. And there's another Michael Conlin, which he, you know, unfortunately they're passed away now. But he really did connect with those cousins, which surprised me.
Mm-hmm.
But my dad would do anything for his sisters, and his mother, and I'm sure his father too. But those Hogans were really, really special to my dad, and to see him talk like that, because he was not a very expressive person,
mm-hmm.
but he would sit there in his chair. In fact, I probably shouldn't say this, but both of these chairs are from our house.
Oh, that's
in Peoria. Yeah, yeah. So he would sit in that chair and just talk about how special that was for him to go to Ireland. And, you know, he went, you know, they would go places, you know, they went to Hawaii and they went other places. You know, they traveled up in Canada and this and that, but never quite talk about those places the way he talked about Ireland. And that's when I really started, you know, you asked when I started getting interested in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that first or second trip when they came back, you know, I just thought, I have to do this. And
What did he say? Can you give me an example?
Well, my dad was not a farm person.
Okay.
But he was very impressed with the land. And the at that part of Clare, just the scenery and the contour of the land. And just how, because I think my dad was a pretty much self-made person, you know, and I think he saw that in Ireland, and he mentioned this quite a bit, is that, you know, they were making do on much less than what we had here, but yet they were very happy, and he really wanted us as kids, you know, to be happy as people. And I think he saw that with them, that the Irish were his family. Were so welcoming to him that really left a mark on him, and they always passed that down to him. My mom was the same way, you know. You speak when you're spoken to, and that's the way my grandparents were too, you know. And you celebrate certain things, you know, especially like Christmas, and you know, and church was always a big thing too. But there's certain things that you just do as a person, and that you hope that, you know, you're. The way you do that is presented to others, and it's kind of passed down that way.
Mm-hmm.
But they were, but my dad was very impressed with how open and accepting people were, and just how their lifestyle, although it wasn't the same as his, was one that was successful, and they were happy, even though they've gone through, you know, well, as they say, it's kind of a sorrowful history, but yet they were, you know, able to just, you know, deal with it and kind of go about their lives. Yeah.
Mm.
But I do remember him talking about that quite a bit. In fact, when we would complain as kids about something, he would always make a mention of, you know, well, you got no, you don't have a leg to stand on. You know, you don't know what your grandparents went through. You know, it's kind
mm-hmm.
of, it was very interesting how he would use that a lot to kind of put us, kind of on an even keel, I think, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about who served in World War II.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
My dad was, as I mentioned, he was working in Peoria for Caterpillar Tractor. He was doing some technical drafts, engineering type of stuff. My dad never really talked too much about World War II. However, he never owned any weapons. So, and we never had weapons as kids, and I don't to this day, and I've never been part of that. So I know that he was not, I'm assuming he was not interested in the Army or the Marines or anything like that. And so he enlisted.
Mm.
And I have somewhere, I'd have to find it in one of those books, it's a little thing out of the Peoria Journal Star about his enlistment group that he went in with. So he enlisted in the Coast Guard. And, you know, I just think that maybe that was a good fit for him. He liked to fish, he liked to do stuff on the water, so I guess, you know, that was a good choice for him. But I don't know if that was, you know, enlist or be drafted, if it was that kind of choice or not, or if he was trying to be preemptive and just get in and do that. I don't know. But he served in the Coast Guard. he was stationed basically in Longview, Washington, which is kind of there by Portland, Oregon, north of Portland, Oregon, for most of the war. I don't, from what he said, what they would do is patrol the coast for, you know, submarines,
right.
Any kind of, especially after Pearl Harbor and things like that. He did have one accident. He took a fall down some steps on the ship that they were on. And he did have some back issues because of that,
mm-hmm.
and but he wasn't. You would never know it, you know. He was just. He was just. That's kind of the way
you
it was.
You know, consider yourself lucky.
Yeah, yeah. So he, but he served his time. He's a veteran of World War II through the Coast Guard.
Mm-hmm.
Never really talked too much about the war, but I do know that he made his views to us. I have an older brother and older sister. Especially during Vietnam, about how we felt. My brother being 4 years older was in more of a threat. He had some definitely anti-war sentiment, and I think that probably came from, you know, his experience in the war, because I do know quite a few people who he knew, you know, didn't come back from World War II, and I think that was something that really impacted him. But he did not want us to participate in. Well, he just didn't believe that the war was right. And my brother was the same way. And so he really encouraged us, because at that time, you know, you either went, when I was in high school, my brother being 4 years older, if you didn't go to college, then you were going to be drafted, because
yes.
we had, you know, we had to register with selective, you know, the service. And you had a draft card and this and that. And my brother, who's 4 years older, he was the first lottery group. So my brother got a high number. And I remember there was great excitement. My dad was also very interested in politics, and they passed that down to the kids, I think, quite a bit. I remember as a kid following Kennedy becoming president, and my brother and dad staying up that night and marking off all the sheets as the election returns came in. And there was that feeling with my dad, and I'm sure he got this from my grandparents, about, you know, you were Catholic and here's a guy who's going to be a Catholic president, and all the kind of negative comments that were made about John Kennedy because of his Catholic faith. I couldn't help but see how that really could form a bond for you know, Irish Catholics. And my dad was very open-minded about things. He didn't make a decision quickly. He was a big thinker. His job at the, so after World War II, he got a job at a bank in Michigan and then wanted to come back down to Illinois. So I was born in Michigan, right, 1952. And then they went down to Peoria, and he worked at the Southside Bank, which is in my neighborhood where he grew up. My dad was kind of interesting. He started out in the loan department, eventually got all the way up to be a vice president of the bank. But he worked with a family-run bank, so there's no way he was ever going to become president. And he used to complain about the wards all the time because he didn't think that they had real good business sense. But my dad made me in summers, a couple summers I worked at the bank. At that time, it was all microfilming. Records,
oh, yes. Uh-huh.
All those, you know, signature cards and all that stuff. And my dad really felt that, you know, you need to have a job and you need to know what the real world was like. And because he always had a job, you know, ever since.
Good work ethic.
Yeah.
And he was instilling that in you.
Yeah. I had a paper route when I was like third grade, delivery papers, you know, and I took that all the way up. And then once I got into sports in high school, then that kind of went by the wayside. But we always had jobs and we were expected that when we were 18 we were probably not going to be living in the house. And he did the same, you know. He went to college 17 or 18 years old and never went back to live in the house, although he lived in the neighborhood. But it was interesting, my dad, when he passed away, and I remember at the wake and then the thing at the funeral home, this black woman came up to me and introduced herself and said that she really admired my dad because my dad hired her. And at that time, being black, she couldn't get a job. And that my dad had some personnel experience that at the bank, too. It was kind of more of a, you know, they did different jobs. But she wanted to thank me for him hiring her at that bank because she was having the hardest time getting a job, and she felt that since she was African American that she might not get a job or whatnot, and so she really wanted to make sure that someone in the family knew that he had gone out of his way.
What year was that he got a job? Do you have any idea?
Well, he passed away in 90, so I'm thinking that probably was mid 70s, because this woman was probably, I think she seemed to be about my age, so I'm thinking.
You're
that.
Just guessing.
Yeah, just guessing. Out of the blue. But so many people, in fact, I had a phone call I made when we moved up here 3 or 4 years ago out to the bank because they wanted some information and the realtor and this and that. And but anyway, when I called back to the bank, they were like, oh, you know, Mike Conlon's kid, you know, how are you doing? Oh, we were, you know, just tell me all these stories about my dad, you know, and I'm on the phone talking to this woman out in Peoria, Illinois, and he's just was very respected in that job as just being always there, retired, but then went back as a consultant. He just really, as you mentioned, he had a huge work ethic, and I think maybe to an extent, maybe a little overboard, but I think that's something that he got from definitely from
early on in his life.
And I'm kind of the same way, although I've always had jobs, and you know, some of them have been better than others, but I just always never felt that I was too good to work a, you know, a job that might not be that socially, you know, especially when I was going through college and things like that. I mean, I scrubbed floors and worked in a movie theater and did all that, and you know, it was just part of the deal.
Do what you have to do to survive.
Yeah, so.
Okay. Let's see here. We're going to talk a little bit about, was it the ship manifest or the passport or something like that?
Yeah.
A couple of those things. Okay.
Well, I have, through Ellis Island, I have my grandfather's ship manifest, and it's just one page. But as I mentioned, he came over because he mentions on there that the Thomas O'Brien family, or Thomas O'Brien had come from Ennistymon, and they're a farm that's right in back of them in Ennistymon. Come on to, because on his recommendation, he came over, according to that record, with $40.
Wow.
Yeah, because on the manifest, they want to know, you know, how much cash or possessions. I think I'll have to look at that, but I think he put 30 or 35, and someone crossed it out and put 40.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's what it came over, you know, and then I'm assuming took the train to Chicago. And then down. Yeah, that would probably make more sense. You know, his, I've done a little research on this. You know, those famine rides over on the ship, I mean, they could last forever. But I think this one was probably under the 2 week time period. From what I understand when I was at Cove, I kind of asked the historian there about that. And most of the, it seems like the ones that left then in that late time period, 1898 or whatnot. And at that time, they called it Queenstown. And mm-hmm. Queenstown, of course, it's Cove, but that's also where, that was the last port of call for the Titanic and the Lusitania, or Lusitania, yeah. So anyway, it has kind of a famous little section there, but came over. What's interesting, too, a little Montana connection, on that page, there's a, they always say where they're going, and there was a family or a group of three people, it's hard to tell, going to Butte City, Montana. So he was actually on in line. He was in line with people who were
on their way to Butte.
On the Butte, yeah. And if you look at that, you know, there are people that are just going all over. But it's just amazing the stories of how they would choose these places to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so he, I read Professor Emmons's book about Beyond the Pale.
You did.
Yeah, and okay. He mentions that a person like my grandfather would be a two-boater.
Right.
Did the jump, did the next jump over. And that book was very interesting, although Illinois was not considered to be that western section that Professor Emmons was talking about.
Yeah, I don't think he discussed that in
Yeah,
that book.
But Illinois, you know, I could see how his thesis about Beyond the Pale could really apply to maybe, you know, where my grandparents were. They were definitely, you know, fit all the characteristics of that group, you know.
And
farmers,
what do you recall as the characteristics going?
Yeah, well, like farmers, Irish Catholic, definitely with the religious part of it. I just think that that neighborhood where they grew up, there were Irish in that neighborhood. There were Ryans. There were also Germans, though, too. And I do remember my grandfather, he had some ethnic issues. You know, he...
What do you remember?
Well, I do remember him, in fact, complaining about the trash man. yeah, and just saying that, you know, this guy would not do a good job, because we would spend time out in the yard together a lot, and kind of complaining that the Germans don't, you know, get it, so to speak. But he did, you know, I used to spend a lot of summers with them, so I got to see him more outdoors a lot, and how he would interact with people. But he was very good friends with, there were, you know, two or three doors down, there were the Ryans, and I'm not mm-hmm. exactly where they were from in Ireland, but the fellow who was his age was definitely from, you know, from Ireland. Mm-hmm. And then eventually I went to school with family members from that. They were O'Briens, but I think they took the O off of it, made it Ryans. But
they made it Ryans.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But, you know, my grandfather, he knew a lot of the older stories. He was not a singer, but he was more of a recitation kind of person.
Okay.
One story about him is to get me to go to bed early as a kid,
mm-hmm.
and he knew I liked baseball, he would always say, you know, if you go to bed early, you'll get up early. And he kind of went from fairies to leprechauns. He would say, you'll be able to find, you know, leprechauns out playing baseball in the morning, but you have to go to bed early to do this. And so, of course, being a young kid, you know, oh, sure, I'll go to bed. Well, you don't want to go to bed in the summer, you know, at 8 o'clock.
No,
but
delightful.
It was a little trick. And, you know, when you're a little kid, you fall for that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one thing I particularly remember about him, because he really knew I liked baseball. And I, you know, oh, Grandpa, I'm not seeing them today. Where are they? Well, you probably didn't go to bed early enough, you know. The other thing, too, with him is he would stash money. And for some reason, he would take me downstairs, and he had a ceiling tile that was up in the basement, and he would stash money up there. Maybe, I don't know, $1, $2, whatnot. And when he passed away, I remember saying that something about that experience, because no one in my family knew about it.
Really?
And so there was like this mad rush downstairs in the basement, you know, tearing the whole basement looking for this money. But I don't know what, maybe that was just his little spending money or maybe his, you know, whatnot. But never any big sums of money were found down there. But anyway, it that was another experience I remember from that house. My grandmother was more of a, she was a homemaker kind of person. We would always go to church on Sunday and spend Sunday afternoon there. It was usually a big ham spread type of deal. She had a little pantry off the side with a lot of canned stuff, kept up with that. It was a really cool kitchen because you walk down a couple steps off the living room like here, and you'd walk down and there's the kitchen out to the back and the pantry off of there and the bathroom. And it was very, very basic. But, and I have a picture of that house, and I showed my cousins that house when I went over to Ireland this November, and they were like, oh my gosh, look at that house. Well, they were really impressed with it, but that part of Peoria is not known for very fancy houses, but it just kind of struck them as, you know, oh, you did okay then.
You did all right.
Yeah, but so I do remember, you know, spending a lot of time around that kitchen table.
Do you?
Yes. And, you know, eating and them talking, you know, just asking us what, you know, we were doing in school. And a lot of you know, obviously grace before your meal and things like that. But, you know, it's been so many years, but yet there's certain things that you just remember, you know. And I do remember them, him stashing money, you know, doing the outside stuff with him. In the kitchen, just being really important, and that was just what you did on a Sunday afternoon, you know.
Do you remember any traditional Irish food?
The only thing I really remember from them is they were very big on ham.
Were they?
Yeah, very big on ham, and I don't know why he got into this. I think it was because, I don't think there's anything to do with Ireland, but he really got into growing turnips. And I know that that's not anything they do over there, but he loved turnips, and they must have grown well there in Illinois. But you know, I do remember always having, you know, some sweets and stuff afterwards too. I do remember as far as traditional kinds of things, you know, the big plate with the ham and white bread sandwiches kind of stuff. We go over, and my mom and dad would always have tea with them in the afternoon, and you know, that was that always, that big plate was there. And you know, of course we'd scarf that when we were kids. But you know, and they had, I think they, my grandparents seemed to be pretty happy with one another. That's hard for me to say. Just what they had to have gone through, and just having that connection with the past, I'm sure it had to have made them pretty tight. He had a couple parakeets that would buzz around the house all the time, and the only time I ever remember her kind of getting on him about it was when the parakeets would get out of the cage and they're like buzzing around. And and then also too, they were really big on Christmas. That was when everybody,
it was a big tradition.
Yes, that's, everybody came to their house.
Came from the Irish heritage.
Yes, everyone came, and it was big because I think it was, you know, this is a time when everybody's going to, you know, even my Aunt Kate, who was in Texas, well, at that time she's in Oklahoma, would come up, the daughters would all come down, my dad's sisters and my aunts would, you know, they'd all come down from Chicago, and we'd all be there. And my Uncle Wayne, who was Joe's husband, just being a card, just, I mean, it was, you know, the smoke in the house was so thick, you know, from them all. You know, but it was all, you know, part of their, just part of what they did. They all got together on that Christmas, and I do remember the doing, you know, getting in touch with birthdays, and those were really big things with them. And then as the daughters started, you know, having health problems and things like that, that kind of really I think when I got maybe later in high school, a lot of that kind of went by the boards.
Mm-hmm.
So, the other thing too I wanted to mention is that they used to talk about, well, I'll let him out here real quick.
Yeah, you bet.
In Ennis Diamond, with the farms being so close, my grandmother's, the Hogans are up on kind of a higher hill. And the Hogans and Conlins have been really tight over there. And whenever since it was all women up at the Hogans, whenever they wanted some help, they would put white sheets out on the hedge or visible so that the Conlins could see that. And then my grandfather or his twin brother would go up and help them with whatever. So that was kind of their little communication system, is that if they needed some help with, whatever farm work they were doing up there, or if they had something that needed to be moved, they put these sheets up, their white sheets, and that was kind of a little sign for them to come up.
Do you know where that came from?
No, I don't.
You don't?
I don't, but I will. Yeah, I'd like to find out more about that, but that was their communication system. For doing that. I just wanted to mention that that there's this tie with Conlins and Hogans. In fact, my cousin Breed Conlin, who's a little bit younger than me, second cousin.
Okay.
We share the great grandfather.
And did you say Breed?
Breed. It's B-R-I-D.
Okay.
Yeah. Breed is really wealth information for the family. But she's a Conlin. One of the Hogan cousins was her godmother. So they've kept this connection through the time. It's pretty amazing when you think about that these farms are still in the family. A lot of people, especially like I noticed with, I might have been in the gathering tape, a fellow was quoted, I think, about going back to Ireland, and all he saw was just the stone foundation of where his grandfather had lived. But I thought, well, that's cool, because at least you can see that. But yeah, I can kind of go another step beyond that, because they're both in the families. Yeah, and my second cousin, Susan. She's a Hogan. She's married to Paul Hayes. They live in West Clare, but they go up once a week to the homestead, the Hogan homestead, and just put the fire on for a Saturday, and the Conlins will come up, or whomever from Ennis Diamond that they want to see will come up to the cottage there. And I have a couple pictures of those. Well, actually, my mom painted that when she was over there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and that's basically what it looks like.
I'll have to get a picture of that as well.
Yeah.
That's all right.
Yeah. And and then I have some pictures that I took of me on the step. But anyway, to go into that Hogan homestead where my, grandmother grew up, to go in the room, Susan, my cousin, was saying, well, this is a room your grandmother slept in. And the same with the Conlins when I went over. But to give it, it was amazing when I went to that homestead of Hogan's, it was just too much. It was, I was choked up.
Mm.
And to see that and to walk around, then to go over to the Conlins and to have the same thing, because Bree Conlin, my cousin, that's the house she grew up in.
Mm.
Here's the room where your grandfather was. And I went around and I took pictures of all the outbuildings, because I think those outbuildings, for farm animals or whatever, stuff that they stored, those are all things that have been there when he was a kid. And to have a picture of that was just that connection with, them. And even though they're buildings, it was pretty amazing. But the fellow who's renting this house where my grandfather grew up, his name was Philip, and he was a writer. I had never met this fellow before.
Okay.
Bree takes me in there. Nice to meet you. He's writing, has a table full of stuff. And Breed said, this is John Conlin, his grandfather grew up in this house. And Philip wanted to know all about the story.
Mm.
And when I started telling him about, well, Breed's grandfather stayed, my grandfather went. And Philip, who I never met before, said, oh, that must have really been a difficult decision, you know, and wanted to get into the whole story. And I was just amazed, you know, and, you know, he's a young fellow, he's probably in his 30s.
What was Philip's last name?
You know, I don't know his last name, yeah, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
Yeah. And then, of course, before he even knew who I was, he said, would you like a cup of tea? You know, and of course we said, yeah. And so we ended up sitting there around the table. And I have to say that this this homestead, it's pretty basic. You know, it's not what they, Breed showed me a couple places, and actually Breed's brother, who passed away, was in that farm for a while, and then once he passed away, then her other brother Michael wanted a new house right there. He didn't want to live in that, so that's why they rent it. But they're not going to touch it, but tear it down or anything. But there are initials scratched in there from Breed's father as a kid growing up in that house. You know, he was a Michael. They called him Mick. You know, MC. And she showed me all these little things, and he had a favorite place that he sat. Her dad. Sat at as a kid, and so I took a picture of her in that same spot. And we were, as my cousin's husband was saying, there will be tears.
Yeah, we get
yeah.
a little teary myself.
Yeah, so it was something that I never forget. That, and then to go back and just to see where they lived, and it just really confirmed a lot of my beliefs that they were just solid people, you know, who had to make a decision but then, you know, to send money to my grandmother kind of behind the scenes there, we've always thought that was kind of, but it kind of goes in line with him, because I could see him. That's why I mentioned that about him stashing money up in the ceiling in the basement, because I think that's what he did. He had to have, and I don't know how much money he made on the railroad when he came over, but he definitely had that in mind with my grandmother. And
you must have loved her.
Oh yeah,
get her over here.
Yeah, and those Hogans were really they were very tight, and to this day they still are. In fact, when we were over there in November, we went up to the Hogans. I'd gone up one day with my cousin Breed, and my wife was there too. And then the next day, we were all going to get together in Anna Steinman. It was a Friday night, so it was a big pub night. So my cousin Susan, who's 75 or 76, met us at the house. We had tea and sandwiches, and we went over to Conlon's, had a big dinner, and went down to the pub. And Susan was down at the pub, and people started coming in saying that they were cousins to me, and I had not even known that. And so when you mentioned that about family, there's a whole other branch of the Conlins, which I've never met. They're all Queeleys. And my grandfather's sister married into the Queeleys. And there were like 15 kids that
wow.
she had. And some of them were boys, so I know that the Queeley name is kept up. I didn't even meet them.
Wow.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, going back a little bit with my great-grandparents, it's interesting because my great-grandmother was a McNamara. And
do you know her full name?
She was a Bridget McNamara.
Bridget McNamara.
Yeah.
Okay.
And my great grandfather was Darby.
Darby.
Darby Conlon. D-A-R-B-Y.
Okay.
Yeah. They were both married before they became husband and wife, and both their spouses had died. And
do you know what
of? No, I don't.
And this
would have been
great grandparents.
Great grandparents, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they were both married. And that would have been.
And this was in Ireland.
In Ireland, same Anna Steinman, County Clare.
And both of their spouses.
Yeah. My great grandmother, McNamara, she was married to a fellow by the name John Doherty.
Okay.
And I met when I was there in November. This is how close those families have kept. A Patricia Doherty, who is related, and I only met her in the pub, which it was crazy. And so when we go back again in November, I want to spend a day with her to figure out all of that. But there's a Doherty connection that goes all the way back to the 1860s, and she's a Doherty, and so I'm related to her somehow.
Wow.
So I have all these connections that I still have to do, and you need more than, last time we were there was only 2 weeks, so I was really working on the Conlins, but I'm going to work on the Doherty section and the Queeleys when I go back over there again in November, which I'm going to go back in. So just that connection and how people stay together, and they're always doing things for them. The Conlins, the Hogans, and Dohertys all get together. You know, Breed Conlin gets together with Tricia Doherty and Anna Steinman, and it's just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm not a big Facebook person, but when I was over there, I realized that I had to, because not only do I have my second cousins, but my second cousin, Michael Conlin, who has the house next to the homestead, he has two kids, Ann Conlin and then Sean Conlin. So I'm a John Conlin, so I got to meet his kid, Sean. And then, you know, then they have, they're married, and they're spouse. And then Breed Conlin and Michael Conlin, they have other siblings that I haven't met, so they were unable to meet us. Mm-hmm. They have kids, and so there's McConnells that are out there too. So it's going to take a while to round them all up. But anyway, I've connected with some of them on Facebook, although they don't know me. So, you know, it's kind of funny that, you know, that social media can help you out in some ways.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So anyway, that's...
Okay, so yeah. If you could sum it up in a way, what does your Irish ancestry mean to you?
Well, and for one, it means a lot, but to know that I'm related, connected to people who went through all of these pretty epic things in Irish history. You know, my great-grandfather, Darby, and grandmother, great-grandmother, McNamara, were really kids of the famine. And for them to survive, in fact, I do know that Darby spent some time in those, a little bit of time in those workhouses. And that was, you know, you were destitute if you were in one of those. And he was a farmer.
Do you know how much time?
There's mention of him on the census, but I don't know the time period.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's also mention of them, talking about family, having one of those Queeleys as a person living in that house. So they've always taken in family, and I think with my dad doing Great Aunt Catherine too, I think there's that kind of taking care of your own. But just have that connection with the great grandparents, and then my grandparents and great aunt being part of that, of Irish history of immigrating to the U.S. and making it, and then passing on, you know, some of the things we talked about earlier that I think have influenced me to this day, you know. So I think that I'm very proud of the fact that there's obviously survived all of that, but they took part in some pretty important pieces of history, world history, but especially for Irish history, and I'm really part of that, you know, so to speak. And then also now being able to go back and do the full circle and connect with them. But I think it means, another thing it means to me too is that because of my grandfather, you probably get a kick out of this. I am interested in, I have applied for Irish citizenship through the dual citizenship because of this descent. And so I would like to honor him by having that. I think he would find that would be pretty amazing. Yeah, my dad was proud of being Irish, but he wanted to be an American.
Mm-hmm.
And so he, you know, was very aware of what it was like to grow up in an Irish household. I would like to have that citizenship as just kind of a way of saying thank you for all the stuff that you've given me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's kind of what I think about that.
That's pretty fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay. If you were to write the history of the Irish of Montana, what would you include for future generations?
Um, I wish there was more Irish history in the Bitterroot, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Yeah, I think there must be, and you know, before when I was a teacher, I did some seasonal work with the Park Service in one place that I worked in the summer, in between teaching contracts, was down here at Big Hole, and the battlefield with the Nez Perce passing through and. And
spent some time there last weekend.
Oh yeah, it's a beautiful spot. I did a lot of work there, but if you go up to that monument that's up there, up in the siege area, and you look at the amount, and you just look at the Irish surnames, mm-hmm. of how the Irish, you know, as Dr. Emmons would say, were, you know, kind of the blunt force. They were in, you know, all of these battles, military stuff, and I just got a book about the Irish soldiers in the Mexican War, the San Patricios, who were fighting in the Mexican War, and they decided to go over onto the Mexican side to fight. And you know, during the Civil War, you know, they were. I went to see the Piper through the Irish Studies program the other night, and he was talking about how he played this song, and it was something that the Confederate troops might be playing as kind of a settling in period at night, you know, and just this connection with Ireland and the military and just what the, you know, the jobs they had to work. I think that is something which could really be explored more here. This valley, Bitterroot Valley. Yeah, Bitterroot has a kind of a sad, to me, kind of a sad history because this is ancestral land for, you know, Salish and, you know, they were basically, you know, told to leave. And but I think, you know, if I were to be interested in knowing more about Montana, I'd kind of like to look at just the average Irish person that was involved in all of these, you know, wars that we've had, and especially with some of the Indian wars with the military. But our history here in this valley, and even Missoula to a certain extent, isn't as great as Butte. I go to Butte quite a bit because I feel that there are more Irish there, obviously, but the connection with the unions, you know, I'm still am, even though I'm retired, teachers union. I feel a really strong bond with that. And that history of Butte, you know, and obviously the buildings, I just love all the buildings that are up there. And, you know, I just think if I were to look at, you know, writing the history, I would hope that connection with Butte would stay there, mm-hmm. you know. And I've noticed that the family that I have in Ireland, they didn't really know much about Butte. They didn't know that there was this whole Western thing. They think of going over, you know, to New York or Boston. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a whole other slice of Irish history out here that I think could really be developed. And you know, I probably would, if I were to write more, if I were to investigate more, obviously it would just be with, you know, the Irish out here and some of the Indian War type of stuff I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that really answers your question or not.
Well, of course it
yeah,
does.
Yeah.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Okay. What do you think are the greatest moments in your life? The most striking? What has caused the most striking changes in your life thus far?
Striking changes?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Where I grew up in Peoria, it's pretty basic.
What's
his name? President Nixon. I forget. He had that comment he made, if it'll play in Peoria, it'll play anywhere.
Right.
And to me, I always looked at that as kind of condescending because it made us people in Peoria look like, you know, we were, you know, kind of, you know, sheep or whatever. but anyway, I grew up in a town that was pretty conservative but very basic, and you know, we had enough, very middle class, and you know, that's what I grew up around. I grew up you know, it's pretty diverse. I went to school with a lot of different people. It was basically pretty Catholic. I mean, I went to Catholic school, grade school, high school. But I hadn't really experienced anything. And when I got out of high school, you know, and I played sports, and I got by on that. I was a big reader, but I wasn't a slacker, but I wasn't interested in school. And sports was what got me through it. And when I got to be a junior, I had a high school teacher, Jim Lewis. I'll never forget this guy. He had graduated from law school and had come back to Peoria, taught at my high school, and I took him for U.S. government. And bingo, that was it. For some reason, that guy just got me interested in, you know, U.S. history, Constitution. Then one thing led to the next, you know, now I'm looking at economics. And that was a big moment for me. But the one thing I remember about him is he was also my counselor. He said that you have to go out and experience the world. And you can always come back to Peoria. And so I really started thinking about that a little bit. And then I realized I wasn't going to be a professional baseball player or anything like that. And I really buckled down the last couple years of school. So when I went to college, I thought, well, let me go to somewhere that is going to be, you know, expose me to different things. So I went to Washington, D.C. And that was a huge, as far as becoming kind of an adult, that was a big thing for me. Mm-hmm. As far as a kid, probably changing things for me would just be kind of getting, I had some experiences that were big confidence builders, mm-hmm. but they were mostly related to kind of achievements and sports and things like that. Never academic. But I would say as a kid, having, well, my dad, even my grandfather, and Uncle Wayne going to baseball games and things like that and watching me, but never being the obnoxious parent in the stands, you know, we lost, hey, you know, we're still going to go get an ice cream cone or whatever. But those were kind of development things for me as a kid. You know, then going to Washington, D.C. was a big event changer for me. Watching my child she was born at home by choice. Mm-hmm. To watch that was incredible. To basically raise her was another changer, because you get out of thinking about yourself and then it becomes all, you know, about the child, and that's good. Mm-hmm. And to watch her develop and do some of the things that she's done, to watch her confidence build, you know, and then not having a relationship work out with her mother the way it should have. There was a lot of stuff involved with that, but her mom was really sick, and now that I look back at that in hindsight, that had a lot to do with it. And then to kind of go in that time period where you're by yourself after that broke up, and then, you know, to find Lorraine and get married, and then have a whole nother section of my life take off and be lucky enough to teach where I've been able to teach. Those are, I think, some, you know, not, and probably there's some other things in there too, but there's, yeah, those are some of the big game changers or big changing moments for me. Yeah.
When we first started this conversation, you talked about going to Ireland and the church steeple.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing that, did you ever get to see that or visualize that?
I try to take a couple pictures on the camera just to see what that would be like. I first heard about that when I was in Cork, and I was telling the fellow that we were going to Cove. My cousin was kidding me about this, Breed Conlon was kidding me about this, telling me that we're on the sadness tour. Because we went to the homestead, we went to the cemetery, and then we went to Cove to see. I said, I have to see these. I have to do this. I just have to do this. I have to go see where they left. I want to see what the water looked like. I want to just see it. And you go to Cove, and you get in that center, and it's, you know, they start talking about this famine ships and the ships, And it's this really loud, you know, just screaming and, you know, wailing and this and that, which wasn't, I don't think, my grandparents' experience, because some of those trips over just ended in tragedy. But, you know, to go see that, and then when I heard the story from this fellow about, oh yeah, go find that steeple, because that's, as they got farther out on the water, they looked back, and that was the last thing they ever saw of Ireland, was that steeple. And that just, I almost lost it when he told me that, to think that, well, maybe he was, well, all three of them, you know, at their points when they left, maybe they were looking at that same spot, you know. So I really focused on that, and I tried to take a couple pictures of that with a camera. I don't know if I did justice to it or not, but I did try to visualize that, just to see what that would be like. But I do know that they had the wake, I guess the American wake, for my grandfather when he left, you know, when he left Ennis Diamond. I do know that family was gathered for that, and they knew he wasn't, that was it. But yet Great Aunt Catherine was, I'm sure they thought that too, but she was able to flip that around. I mentioned that to someone too, and he said that was pretty unique for people to go back like that, especially at that age. And they refer to her over there as the Yank. Yeah, and there are people over there that still, oh yeah, the Yank, your great Aunt Catherine. So that was pretty funny. But they do, they know, they just know the history, which is somewhat superior to what we have here. I kind of feel like we lose a little bit of that with each generation, but boy, they just seem to really have it tight. And then just, they gave me this book. They went out of their way. It's from the Clare Heritage Center, and it talks about the Conlins, not the Hogans. Now, I can do this for my grandmother, but I just haven't had the time recently. But it's all of the information about, you know, Conlins and Hogans over, or Conlins. And so they gave that to me, as well as this, Michael Conlin, my cousin, that's Breed's brother, his daughter Anne is married to this fellow David. Mm-hmm. And I never met him or her, or him, Michael, for that matter. And they presented me with this, with that photo. And so I was just really amazed. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when I think about it, it's almost like a dream. But I do want to keep connected with them. And as I mentioned, the citizenship might be a way for me to maybe spend some of the time over there. I don't know. I have to see, my wife's still working, but if it could work out, I would like to spend time over there, maybe half and half. I love Montana, I do feel that there's a kind of a drawing type of thing back there, maybe, I don't know.
Something drawing you?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like you can always go back to Peoria, you can always go back to Ireland.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, maybe. Peoria, I still have fond memories of Peoria. My sister couldn't stand it. She lives out in Bellingham. And my brother, he unfortunately passed away a few years ago, but he always used to say that if a strong wind got going off of the Illinois River, it could blow that whole south side of Chicago, or whole south side of Peoria down.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, my grandparents and my dad grew up. Yeah. But I've always had fond memories of Peoria. But, you know, I don't have the family there.
Yeah.
But then to think of them too, and my grandparents, you know, it was kind of touching when I went back to the cemetery, and there's the Conlins buried up there at Ennis Diamond, and then to think of my, and the Hogans, Johanna and Great Aunt Catherine together, but when I think of my grandmother, you know, buried in Illinois, it's just that, I don't know, it's one thing, I think, to emigrate now, because you can go back easier. But back then, they must have just, how do you just cut that off? It's just amazing, yeah, to know that. But so many things to think about with that whole experience that I still haven't sorted it all out yet.
Well, yeah. John, this yeah. has been a fantastic interview.
Oh,
well, Thank you
I hope
very
that,
much for
yeah,
your time.
Yeah, I hope that, I'm sure you get a lot of them.
I don't know, sometimes. I'm going to go ahead and stop this.
Yeah. Now.